The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening. All right. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. I'm Andrew Nurkin. I'm the Deputy Director for Enrichment and Civic Engagement here at the Free Library. And tonight, it's my pleasure to introduce Nicole Dennis-Benn and Rebecca Mackay. June happens to be both LGBTQ Pride Month and Immigrant Heritage Month. So it's, I think, especially fitting that the new books by tonight's authors tell deeply beautiful stories about queer life, immigrant experience, and the intersections of the two. Called A Brave and Brilliant Triumph of a Book, Nicole Dennis-Benn's new novel, Patsy, tells the story of a young Jamaican woman who leaves her daughter behind to immigrate to New York in search of love and self-determination. It's also the story of that daughter, True, who forges her own identity in a culture that fails to understand her. Nicole Dennis-Benn is the author of Here Comes the Sun, which was a New York Times notable book and winner of the Lambda Literary Award. Born and raised in Kingston, Jamaica, she teaches at Princeton and lives with her wife in Brooklyn. Rebecca Mackay's novel, The Great Believers, summons back to life Chicago in the 1980s as AIDS began to show the full reach of its devastation. It follows Yale Tishman, a young fundraiser for a university art museum who struggles to stay afloat amid the swelling tide, and his friend Fiona Marcus, who 30 years later in Paris seeks to fully account for the toll AIDS took on her life and family. The Great Believers won the LA Times Book Prize, the American Library Association Carnegie Medal, the Stonewall Award, and was named by the New York Times as one of the 10 best books of 2018. Rebecca Mackay is the author of The 100-Year House, The Borrower, Music for Wartime. She is on the MFA faculties of Sierra Nevada College and Northwestern University and is the artistic director of Story Studio Chicago. Both The Great Believers and Patsy are books about family in all its forms, mothers and daughters in all their complications, and the essential struggle and sacrifice of staking a claim for oneself in a world alternating between ambivalence and antagonism. Please join me in welcoming first Nicole Dennis-Benn and then Rebecca Mackay to the Free Library.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you so much for having me this evening. It's a pleasure to be here in Philadelphia. So my wife actually was very excited, given that you know her family is from this area, Bryn Mawr, Pennsylvania, but a couple miles away. So I am here to talk about Patsy, to give a brief reading, and also talk about Patsy a little bit. So of course you just heard the description as to what this book is about. But really, for me, it was important for me to write a story like this one, not only an immigrant story, but the story about a complex woman, a woman who actually wants to find her place in the world and feels the need to do this by coming to the United States, feeling that, you know, it's a fantasy. The roads will be paved with gold. But only to realize that as an undocumented immigrant, it's not as easy. In addition to that, she's running away from the role of motherhood, which kind of just happened to her at a young age. And so for her, it was important for her to actually, you know, kind of, well, you know, a very unpopular decision to abandon her daughter in Jamaica, her 5-year-old daughter, True, in Jamaica, to be this woman she wants to be, to actually find her own identity. So the scene I'm about to read, really, it's chapter 22, and it really taps into the disappointment that Patsy meets when she gets to America, and that conversation that she's now having with her roommate / coworker. So without over-explaining this, I'm just going to jump into this scene for you. There are two types of devil's cold, one in which you cannot bring yourself to leave the room, much less the bed, to do the simplest things. The other in which you go through the motions in a constant stupor. Patsy lies in bed, turned away from the dark, heavy thing that has returned, its shadow dimming the room. With the cover over her head, she closes her eyes, not wanting to see it. God knows how long she has gone without eating. She could die, she knows. Though death doesn't seem that scary after all. Not as scary as the dark thing. Here in America, there are no bush teas for it. No bitter mix of ramgoat roses, rosemary, lemongrass, bissy, and other herbs. No pastor to come with a bottle of sanctified olive oil. No neighbor from the country who can wring the neck of a goat and sever it with a machete for you to bathe in its blood. No time to lie down and let it run its course. She's powerless against it. The real hell is allowing this place to eat you alive, Fiona says to Patsy, when she notices that she has been lying in the same spot on the bed inside their studio from sunup till sundown. How many rotations has the sun gone through since Patsy climbed into the bed that night after seeing Cicely? She slips in and out of sleep. She wakes to Fiona shaking her. Patsy, Patsy, Patsy. It reminds Patsy of her daughter's voice, how it would pull Patsy from the lips of a deep sleep. Here she's in the midst of it, hating it, terrified of it. And yet, her only thought is of True, her daughter. During those years, it was the anticipation of going to America to see Cicely that had kept Patsy alive. But what is keeping her alive now? Where will she find the strength that would protect her from the spells? How can she live knowing that she lost Cicely to her American dream? It's then that what Fiona had said about not having the luxury of choosing love makes sense to Patsy. That's all it comes down to, choice. When has she ever been given a choice? Never. She was never given the choice to say no the first time her legs were pried open. Never given a choice to rid her body of the grievance she had carried for 9 months. Never given a choice to look at another woman and allow herself to be carried by the feeling without blood, bright red on glistening glass, sticking to her like shadow. And now the promise of life comes with accepting the fact that she will never have a choice. Come, let's go, Fiona says. I told Alan you was coming in tonight, that you was running a high fever, but that you would be all right now. You want to get fired? I can't, Patsy tells her. What do you mean you can't? Fiona sits on the bed, her weight pressing down on the mattress. She puts her arms around Patsy. You've been like this for a week now. This is not a place to feel sorry for yourself, you hear? I can't take this. Can't take what? Come. You must push through whatever you're going through. We're in this together. I'm sure you didn't come to this country to die. There's a difference between wanting to die and not wanting to live. Patsy doubts she can explain this to anyone. She's tired of dealing with the dark thing mocking her as a nameless, faceless interloper on foreign soil. Before, it had mocked her as a helpless secretary in Jamaica, trapped inside a cubicle, an unwilling mother with no way out but inside her dreams. Patsy cannot afford to go back to that either. She wishes to confide this to Fiona, but it would be less of a hassle if she can make Fiona go away and leave her alone. So when Fiona tugs the sheet from Patsy, Patsy delivers the blow. I had sex with Alric. A hush falls inside the room when Fiona steps back. As she glances up at Fiona, she sees the vulnerability there in her eyes, the exposed vein in her neck. All that is preventing Patsy now from pulling the blade with her tongue, telling Fiona how Alric had pressed her up against the wall right there where she stands looking down on her and fucked her good and hard, is the pity she sees on Fiona's face. Patsy expects her to lash out, hit her, tell her to leave, but she doesn't. Then quietly, shamefully, Patsy says, I'm sorry. Fiona only laughs, clasping her hands together to cup her mouth. It sounds genuine, like that of a woman who has known every secret there is to know and has pitied the person thinking she could be so naive. Patsy stares at her, puzzled, at the sight of the tearful gratitude her confession has brought to her roommate. The dark cluster breaks and falls apart in her panic. "Girl, please," Fiona says. "Is that why you sit down on yourself? That man would screw anything in a dress. That's just how they are, especially Caribbean man. Don't you know that? Your men especially. Child, please." "So you knew?" Patsy asks. "No, but I know his dick and what it's capable of." "And you okay with it? Look here, I judge a penis different from the man. Why hate a man for his faults? Who he loves and who he screws are separate. We have been friends for longer than we've been lovers. That's the only thing keeping us together, comfort. I'm glad you told me. I consider you a friend too. I know this might sound foolish, but him weakness don't make him a bad person. Neither does yours. When you fall in love with your best friend, it's different. You accept everything about them, the good, the bad, and the downright ugly." Sitting back down on the bed, Fiona strokes Patsy's arm. "Maybe you should talk to somebody." "Somebody like who?" Fiona shrugs. "Someone you can confide in. Someone who can help you. Like a professional. Cause rather than watch you do such a piss poor job at slowly killing yourself, I'd rather kill you myself," she jokes. Patsy's voice trails. "Who hasn't thought about giving up?" Fiona asks, reading her mind. "This place don't make it easy for us. It's like we're walking upon hot coal. At least in sleep, we can dream. But the weirdest thing about life is that it's only understood backward. You never know what's at the end of this tunnel waiting for you, sweetheart. Now come get dressed. We got life to live and rent to pay." So that's the first, the middle of the book, where of course it's obvious you see Patsy really struggling with her new home in America. And one of the reasons why I wanted to depict that is that when I, over the years reading immigrant stories, I kind of found it hard, I mean, except for Edwidge Danticat, I hardly saw many depiction of working class immigrants, those who came here for financial reasons. So Patsy, you know, is coming from Jamaica. She doesn't have the education, neither does she have the documentation. And so for her, even though she desires upward mobility, like a lot of immigrants, there is a wall, literally, no pun intended, that she's running into. And so I wanted to really write that and through the point of view of this Jamaican working class woman, you know, this woman who doesn't have status, this woman who, you know, wasn't coming here in a lottery or through marriage, any of that. And also, you know, walking through this world now, finding herself, because as she's walking, as she's doing these odd jobs, I mean, she becomes a nanny on the Upper West Side. And I did that because I wanted to increase the internal conflict for Patsy, a woman who definitely doesn't feel she can actually live up to that role, the high standards or the expectations of motherhood. And so for her to be that nanny, you know, gives that internal conflict that I wanted that character to walk with. While in the meantime, the book also follows her daughter, True, which I'm going to actually read a short scene introducing you to True. But True is coming of age in Jamaica, questioning her mother's abandonment. You know, like, why did she leave? And how come after 10 years, it had been 10 years, no letters, no phone calls, no gifts, nothing, just silence. And so True is growing up really questioning this and also questioning kind of like her self-worth, but more than anything else, coming into her own gender identity and queerness. And so I wanted to really tap into, have True stay in Jamaica, for me to also tap into the culture there as well. You know, here you have, there's this label, barrel child. And basically what that is actually children living on the island that get gifts or, you know, products from parents living abroad, sending them those things, right, those gifts. They're, you know, like 3-inch tall barrels. 3 feet tall barrels, and you can pack gifts, food, clothing items, anything like that. So these children get the nickname barrel children. And so when I first started the novel, I was actually writing True as a barrel child. But then I realized that, well, you know what, I've heard this story too many times. And though, yes, it's common and there's stigma attached to it, I wanted to actually put a spin on gender in this book, because here, you know, you have a woman leaving, but men do it all the time, right? So of course her mother left. In addition to that, she's kind of considered a barrel child, but not, because she's not getting those gifts. She's not really getting the, you know, anything having to do with her parents being abroad. She's just there. Everybody in the community knows that her mother is in America, but they're also watching this tragedy, you know, her just not hearing from this woman, her mother. And so for her, she's also living with that shame, that stigma of the child, of the motherless child, right? Because everybody knows her mother didn't die, right? So it's a different story in that as well. So I'm just going to introduce you briefly now to Trudy Ann. And this is actually, again, later on in the book, she's a teenager, because the book starts when she's 5 years old. So now we're meeting True now at 16 years old. And this is a very brief scene, actually. Okay, here we go. True prefers to wait until the locker room clears. She doesn't have to wait long, because as soon as she enters, the girls cover themselves with their towels or whatever they can find, their eyes sliding toward her, then down. They dress themselves in record speed, scurrying out of the locker room, giggling freely outside as if they have just narrowly escaped death. Once there's nothing but the sound of water dripping from the showerhead, True hurries to change out of her uniform and into her soccer gear. She pulls a white polo shirt over her head. She examines herself in the long mirror to make sure there are no bumps on her chest. But she still sees them. No matter how tight she does the bandage, she never feels secure. For good measure, she lifts her t-shirt and undoes the bandage, slowly releasing her breath before she adjusts it once again. A light sheen of sweat breaks out on her forehead. She sucks air, grits her teeth, and pulls, bearing a slight pain. She starts to sweat in the heat, and her breath pales as a sob compresses her lungs. It comes out as a gasp. Does it take you a while to do that? True freezes at the sound of the voice. When she turns, Saskia Rawlings is standing behind her. She's already dressed in her netball gear, a white polo shirt with the school's name written on it, a short pleated blue skirt that shows her knobby kneecaps and long legs with a pair of shiny shin bones, and a pair of white sneakers that look extra white next to her brown skin. "You're not flat-chested after all," she says to True, taking a few steps toward her. "Why not at practice?" True asks, suppressing her heavy breathing and quickly wiping away sweat and tears of frustration that had fallen down her cheeks. "I was late," Saskia says. "Coach benched me." True knows that Saskia saw her. She waits for the questions written on Saskia's face. Up close, it resembles a rich, dark cut of velvet. True looks away. "So is it true?" Saskia asks. "Girls are talking all over school." "That is none of their business," True says too quickly. "That's what I tell them too," Saskia says. True grabs her things. "I have to go." "It's okay. I won't tell anyone." "What's there for you to tell?" True asks, slinging her book bag over one shoulder. Saskia shrugs. "It looks painful. Not as painful as having breasts." "I don't know about you, but I like breasts." "Good for you," True says. "I meant to say I didn't take it anyway," True says. She can't help but smile. "Wow, I never expected to see that," Saskia tells her. "What, you smiling? You're always so serious." "There's not much to smile about." "That's too bad." The 3:25 freeze bell goes off outside, a call for abrupt silence on campus, where all the students, teachers, and staff are expected to stop what they're doing for a full minute of reflection, a tradition adopted from their British founders. True is stuck here with Saskia in the quiet, which sweeps through the empty locker room. She struggles under the blanket of stillness, feeling herself falling into a rare spell of shyness, fidgeting beneath the merciless hand on the clock and Saskia's knowing gaze. The moment seems to last longer than a minute, longer perhaps than anything True has ever endured in her whole life. When the bell rings again to end the freeze, Saskia is the first to speak. Is someone coming for you afterwards? No. Do you want me to walk you to the bus stop in Halfway Tree? You'd risk that? Risk what? They might say you're tainted. Saskia puts her hands on her narrow hips. I dare them. Maybe another time, True says, smiling. Saskia nods and bites her bottom lip as she digs inside her book bag and fishes a pen. Here. Opening True's palm, she scribbles a number in the middle. True's hands shake a little. Saskia doesn't seem to notice. When she's done, she looks up at True. Before she says anything, her teammates enter the locker room and she discreetly lets go of True's hand. But her touch echoes all over True's skin. The girls' laughter and chatter fill the space. They greet Saskia, surrounding her with their babble about how unfair coach was today. True uses the opportunity to slip out. Right. And that's the last scene I'll share with you, given time. But of course, I'm happy to do the Q&A afterwards, so feel free to ask any questions about Patsy. Thank you.
Hi. It is so wonderful to be here. I've been hearing about this library for years. This is my first, this is my first time ever in Philadelphia, despite having gone through your airport about 85 times. So really excited to be here. So one of the things that's happened in the past year, as I've been on the road with, so The Great Believers came out in hardcover about a year ago, and it just came out in paperback on Tuesday. And one of the things that's happened is that I've gotten really sick of reading certain passages again and again. So I found a new one that I could read as I go around this week. And it makes me really happy to read it because it's about 1986 Chicago Pride Parade. And those of you who know the book, don't worry, there are no spoilers in this one because that's a chapter that happens quite late in the book, but I'm being very careful here. This is The Great Believers, as Andrew said, is about, we're mostly following one guy named Yale from 1985 to 1992 as the AIDS epidemic swirls closer to him and his friends, and as his life both falls apart and takes on much greater meaning. What I need to let you know in this passage, and of course I just turned to the wrong passage, this passage, is that, so it's 1986, Pride Parade is still pretty small, but growing. You need to know that Harold Washington was the mayor of Chicago. Harold Washington was the first African-American mayor of Chicago, I believe, of any major American city. I could have that wrong. A lot of people would also say that he was gay and in the closet. We'll never know. But it was true that he was, compared to other mayors in other cities, he was much more ready to help in this crisis. The problem is that in just very shortly after this time I'm writing about, he died very suddenly in office of a heart attack. And we got the second Mayor Daley, who needed to be brought around on some things. So it's 1986. Yells at this parade. There are two floats that he knows that are going to go by. One, he's watching for his friend Asher. He has had a burning crush on Asher. Asher's a lawyer. He's had a burning crush on him that he's never going to do anything about. And the other is his ex, Charlie. Now, this is the one spoiler, but if you've read even 20 pages of the book, it will not shock you that they've broken up because Charlie's a major piece of work. Okay. By the time he got to Clark... Oh, I'm sorry. One last thing. No, never mind. I'm just going to read. You'll just figure it out. By the time he got to Clark, the route was packed, and the first few floats had gone by. He wound his way behind people, looking for someone he recognized. At Wellington, he looked for Ross and his friends and their fire escape, but not too hard. After two blocks, he spotted Katsu Tatami across the street, and when a few people ran across behind the Anheuser-Busch float, he crossed too. He didn't know the guys Katsu was standing with, but Katsu was always good for a hug, an enthusiastic greeting. He had to shout in Yale's ear, "So far, so good. You want my soda?" He thrust a McDonald's cup at Yale, and a thought about germs flashed across Yale's mind, but he willfully ignored it. He took a sip and then wished he hadn't. Warm, flat sugar water. A bunch of Harleys rolled past, followed by a lesbian dojo, women kicking and chopping their way down the street, dressed in white. Miss Gay Wisconsin, earnest middle-aged women with P-flag signs. A huge brass bed pulled by a convertible and occupied by two men making out with tremendous gusto, their torsos bare above a thin white sheet. I should say here that my research for the 1986 Chicago Pride Parade was YouTube-based, and it was fabulous. I had a very good time researching. Yale asked Katsu how he was, and Katsu said, "I'm becoming a legal expert." He explained, shouted, that he'd gotten new insurance 2 years ago. In January, he was feeling terrible and finally got tested, and he had it. Did Yale know? Yeah, son of a bitch. He hadn't even told his mom. And his goddamn insurance was trying to claim that the virus was a pre-existing condition so they wouldn't have to cover it. Even though I got the insurance before the fucking test came out. But they're claiming I should have known because 3 years ago I was treated for thrush one time. And that's enough for them to turn me down. He needed pentamidine treatments. And he'd need hospital care that wasn't at fucking County, where he'd been a couple of times, and was Yale aware of what it smelled like in there? There was a reason it was free. So Asher was helping him apply for Social Security, for the Social Security he had to have before he could get Medicaid, because apparently that was how things worked in this stupid country. And do you know what I have to prove? Okay, this is insane. We have to prove I'm disabled, which I am now, because I could work 4 days a week, but the fifth day I get the runs so bad I'm glued to the bathroom floor. This was tenable for his part-time gig at Howard Brown, but not for the administrative assistant work that used to pay the bills and supply the useless insurance. But the runs aren't a disability category, I guess, so Asher's finding me this junior litigator. And here's what he has to prove at this hearing. He has to show that I can't do any unskilled sedentary labor in the national economy, like the entire nation. And the fucking examples they used. Do you want to hear the examples? Yale was exhausted just listening to Katsu, but sure, he wanted to hear. A drag queen passed on stilts in an elaborate Statue of Liberty costume, all green sparkles and gauze. I shit you not, nut sorter. That's not a euphemism, by the way. Bowling ball polisher, also not a euphemism. Silverware wrapper, like sitting there wrapping silverware in napkins. Everyone wants their spoons handled by a guy with the AIDS runs, right? Wafer topper. I don't even know what that means. The last one, for real, is fishhook inspector in Alaska. They don't care that I can't get to Alaska and I could never get this job. They care that it's a job in the national economy. So yeah, my survival now depends on my proving I can't top wafers. Here came a bunch of guys in leather, a poster that read, "Bound up with pride." Some kind of garden club followed. But I'm going to get in on whatever clinical trials I can. "And Asher's helping," Yale said. "Yeah, Asher. He can sort my nuts whenever he wants, am I right?" Yale felt his face catch fire. "Oh, come on, you'd let him polish your bowling balls." Yale attempted a noncommittal laugh. And here, ridiculously, before he could properly recover, was Asher's AFC float. Here was Asher waving like a politician. Yale waved, but he didn't catch Asher's eye. Three guys on unicycles came next, cutoffs and denim vests. A series of aldermen and state senators in convertibles, most looking pained. The Out Loud float, this is his ex's newspaper, a red flatbed truck. Yale took a small step back so Katsu couldn't see his face, so he didn't have to worry what his eyes and mouth were doing. Poster board signs all over it, "Fight Out Loud for Safer Sex," and "Out Loud Says Cover Your Head." Six beautiful shirtless men, Yale didn't recognize them except for Dwight, the copy editor, angling cucumbers from their crotches, slowly rolling rubbers onto them, peeling them off, doing it again, opening new packets with their teeth, milking the crowd for cheers. From the side of the truck, Gloria and Raphael threw rubbers from a bucket. He couldn't see Charlie, and then suddenly he could. He had shaved his beard. He was the one holding the boombox that blasted, "You spin me round." Yale tried to wrap his mind around the whole thing, but his body was busy reacting with some strange combination of high and low blood pressure. A Trojan hit Katsu on the chest, and he caught it, laughing, and handed it to Yale. He said, "I'm a lifestyles man, you want?" And although Yale could not see an occasion in which he'd want to use a rubber that had come indirectly from Charlie, he stuck it in the pocket of his shorts. He'd need to get used to them. Yale wished the out loud float would disappear, but it was still making its slow way down Clark, Trojans still flying. Someone scratched him between the shoulder blades, and he turned to see Teddy, grinning, bouncing. "Look who came out of hiding," Teddy said. Yale should have known that Teddy might have been part of Katsu's group. And honestly, it was good to see him. Good, especially, that Teddy was talking as if he didn't think Yale was a monster. A lot of people in their friend group are blaming Yale for the breakup with Charlie, and it was very fraught. Teddy told them about the Klan activity in the park. He said, "They're gone now. They didn't want to actually see any of this, you know. They left before the parade started." Katsu said, "I bet half are secretly sticking around. Bet they're jacking off under their robes." Only one guy had a robe, actually. I found that so weirdly disappointing. They had, like, combat gear with those weird little shields. Yale said, "What do they even want besides attention?" According to their giant banner, they want to quarantine the queers, real original. Anyway, we yelled back for a long time, and then these dykes made out right in front of them. Then they just packed up. Anyone want a hot dog? There was no point trying to move till the parade was over, and when it finally was, they followed the crowd to the park for the rally. Katsu took off, and Yale found himself alone with Teddy in an endless line for food. Yale said, "I hope we're still friends." "I was mad at you," Teddy said, "but it was temporary. I was judging you for being judgmental." Ironic, right? The line lurched, and Yale checked to make sure the guys behind them were strangers. He said, "I feel like we're caught up in some huge cycle of judgment. We spent our whole lives unlearning it, and here we are." "The thing is," Teddy said, "the disease itself feels like a judgment. We've all got a little Jesse Helms on our shoulder, right? If you got it from sleeping with 1,000 guys, then it's a judgment on your promiscuity. If you got it from sleeping with one guy once, that's almost worse. It's like a judgment on all of us, like the act itself is the problem, and not the number of times you did it. And if you got it because you thought you couldn't, it's a judgment on your hubris. And if you got it because you knew you could and you didn't care, it's a judgment on how much you hate yourself. Isn't that why the world loves Ryan White so much? How could God have it out for some poor kid with a blood disorder? But then people are still being terrible. They're judging him just for being sick, not even for the way he got it." Yale tended to find Teddy mentally draining, but he was right this time. Way over at the bandstand, Mayor Washington had begun to speak. "As a black man who has suffered discrimination," he was saying, "as part of a race of people who have suffered." And Teddy said, "He's a good one, yeah? We lucked out." Okay, before I read you one last short section, I want to say, one of the big, most challenging things about writing this book is that my characters and their real-life counterparts, I didn't base characters on real people, but most of my research, which was extensive for this book, was interview-based with survivors. And all of these people were railing constantly, then as now, against the idea of some cosmic force, Catholic God, whatever it was, who was deciding who got sick and why as punishment, as cause and effect, right? And, you know, this disease was and is brutally random. There isn't a ton of logic. One of the things that completely fascinated me as I was talking to people was what happens to grief, what happens to guilt over 30 years, that long arm of survivor's guilt. And, people who all their entire friend group died in their 20s and they were spared and they don't know why. People who got sick and thought they had 2 months, and here they are 30 years later. There's a really complex psychology. There was one person I was talking to who, he was in the middle of telling me about a friend of his, someone fairly prominent from ACT UP back in the day. So he's had a lot of occasion to talk about him. And at a certain point, he stopped himself and he said, "You know, I feel really weird when I talk about Danny because we were really close for a couple of years in our 20s, and then he died. And if he'd lived, we probably would have drifted apart. And he would have been just another friend I knew in my 20s. But he died, and I've gone on to have much more meaningful, much longer relationships. But because I was the closest to him when he died, I'm in charge of his legacy. and I need to keep holding on to him, and I don't feel worthy of that. And it was one of the many reasons that I started to introduce, as I was writing, a thread of the narrative that comes in the modern day, what was then the modern day, it was 2015, which now feels like ancient history. I'm going to tell you about more about that in a second. But meanwhile, what I'll say is that I was, and this is something we can talk about in the Q&A, certainly I won't talk about it too much up here, I had a lot of apprehension and worry and what I would call healthy terror about writing across difference, writing across demographic difference as a straight woman. Also generational difference, which turned out to be more of a challenge for me than anything else. But one of the many ways that that manifested, one of the many things I was worried about, was that there seemed like no way that I, as the author, as essentially the god of this universe, that same force that these real people were railing against, I'm it in this book for these imaginary characters who've become very real to me. And there was no way that I could make any one person get sick that didn't seem like a judgment. And, you know, is the promiscuous person going to get it? Is the person who is very careful going to get it? What do those things mean? Does it seem like I'm saying something with that? And all I could do, and I think so often the solution when I, for me at least, when I have an impasse in my writing is to write that impasse into the book. And so Teddy's speech right there is really me taking that impossibility. There is no right way for this to happen. And handing it to my characters, because they were very much grappling with it. Anyway, about that modern day thread, most of our story stays with Yale, but every other chapter, and they're much shorter chapters, they're about a quarter of the length and about a quarter of the weight, is a woman named Fiona. We knew her in the 80s when she was 21. Now it's 2015, she's in Paris to, don't really worry about this, she's in Paris to track down her estranged daughter. It doesn't matter for this section. She's 51. And she's really lived her life in the shadow of this epidemic. Her older brother's memorial service starts the book. And she is very, very close with Yale as well, and with many of these men. She has stayed working in this field, and as an adult, her job is that she runs a resale shop that benefits AIDS housing. This is a very short passage, and it's the last thing I'll read you before we go and sit down. When she got to Paris, the friend she was staying with was from Chicago, from back in the day, and he had these photo albums that he wanted her to look at of her brother and his friends, and she wasn't ready. But now she's alone in the apartment, and she is. There were probably 20 albums on that shelf, a fact Fiona hadn't absorbed that first day. Rows of black leather, brown leather, colored canvas. Boxes full of slides as well, but she wouldn't mess with those. When she pulled a thick red album off the shelf, though, a paper slipped out and landed on the floor. Fiona attempted to clutch the album closed before anything else fell, but she dropped the whole thing, and now there were papers everywhere. Cream-colored sheets folded in half, small cards, a lavender page with a grainy photo of a man. They were funeral bulletins and prayer cards. She got on her knees and started stacking them up. This wasn't a photo album at all, she saw, when she opened it to an old clipping from Out Loud Chicago, an obituary of someone who danced with the Alvin Ailey Theater, Jesus. She opened the album at the beginning and tried to slide the papers back into the empty spots. A man named Oscar, no one she remembered, had died in 1984. A clipping about Katsu Tatami from 1986. Here was the bulletin for Terrence Robinson, Nico's Terrence. Jonathan Bird, Dwight Sumner. There were so impossibly many. In her current life, it happened at least once a week that someone would wander into the store. And then, when they discovered its mission, say something like, "Oh, I remember that time." Fiona had learned to check her temper, to push her toes into the floor so her face didn't change. "I knew someone whose cousin had it," they'd continue. "Did you ever see Philadelphia?" And they'd shake their heads in dismay. And how could she answer? They meant well, all of them. How could she explain that this city was a graveyard? That they were walking every day through streets where there had been a Holocaust, a mass murder of neglect and antipathy? that when they stepped through a pocket of cold air, didn't they understand it was a ghost? It was a boy the world had spat out. Here in her hand, a stack of ghosts. And I will stop there. Thank you so much.
Hi, everyone. I'm Cynthia Schemmer. I work here at the Free Library. I'm going to be moderating this Q&A. I really want to thank Rebecca Mackay and Nicole Dennis-Benn for being here and for those amazing readings. So let's open it up to your questions.
I was wondering where your motivation to write this book came from.
Yeah, maybe we can both do that. What was the origin story? So for me, this book started in a very different place. I had the idea that I wanted to write about a woman who had been an artist's model in World War I era Paris. And for those of you who haven't read the book, she is still in the book. It didn't go that far awry. But the idea was I wanted this woman, and I wanted her, I started thinking about what it would be like to be a woman in a time before, you know, when women really didn't have the resources to make their own art, a woman who might see being a muse as her art form. And I was going to be all the affairs she had. It was going to be this whole thing. And I wanted her looking back from the end of her life, which mathematically, I realized, couldn't be later than the 80s. And I wanted to set it there so that I wouldn't have to do a ton of research. Haha. That didn't turn out too well. I did, you know, 4 years of research. But because I had it in the 80s, and I had her working with the art world, I saw this as an opportunity to also write about the AIDS epidemic, which is something I've been interested in writing about for a very long time. So my original plan was going to be that she was watching the news, and a painting would come up on the news, recently discovered, of questionable authenticity. Might be by this famous artist, but maybe not. And she alone would know because it's a painting of her. And so she's trying to contact people and explain. And I was about to leave for a residency, and my husband asked what I was going to work on. Like an artist, you know, I was going to go like write for 2 weeks. And I told him this story, and he very gently said, honey, you know that's the plot of the movie Titanic? Where she's watching TV, and there's that sketch they dig up, and she's like, that's me, and I shall tell. And I was like, oh, crap. And so I got to this residency, which is in like rural Wyoming, and I have nothing to do but write, and I'm staring out the window at these like elk going past. I'm in the most beautiful place on earth, and I was like, what did I do? I did a lot of yoga that week. I revised a lot of short stories. But I started really thinking about the book and thinking, okay, first of all, I'd been starting my research, and I was starting to see some really interesting parallels. I was seeing this time, you know, I came across this quote early on from F. Scott Fitzgerald talking about his generation, saying we were the great believers. And I found that so odd, because that's not what we usually think about that generation. And I looked up the full essay it's from, and part of it is an epigraph on the book. He was talking about before the war. He was saying, you know, we believed in American greatness, in our destiny as soldiers. And I started thinking about that generation, especially the visual arts, the visual artists who came to Paris because it was the age of the Art Academy from all over the world. They were poor. They were living in these little hovels. They found each other. They were making art. They had chosen family. And then World War I and the influenza of 1918 rolled through and decimated that generation, largely of its young, able-bodied men. And it's in the aftermath of that that we know about the American writers going over there to Paris, recovering, and that's when Gertrude Stein says to Hemingway, you are all a lost generation. And the parallels for me between that generation and the AIDS generation of a city like Chicago, of a city like Philly, a city like New York, were really striking. And that sense of aftermath, you know, it's an ongoing crisis, but in terms of the height of it, we're in this kind of extended, lingering 30-year aftermath. And I've realized that was the core of my book. So the one thing I wrote towards this book in that residency was a letter, it's not in the book, from the character who would become Nora to the character who would become Yale, talking about returning to Paris after the war and everyone was gone. And that became the core of the book. So, yeah.
So for me, my inspiration for writing Patsy, so Patsy had been with me since 2012. I had just started an adjunct position teaching at the College of Staten Island. So of course I was waking up very early in the morning, riding the Staten Island ferry. I'm riding the 4-5 train from Crown Heights to the Staten Island ferry. And I was riding with these immigrants, these Caribbean immigrants. And I found it very interesting because, of course, I know they were Caribbean because they were talking to each other. It's like they probably knew each other before on this commute. So I was kind of like that new person on this commute, just observing. And right over our heads, you know, you'd see the things like come to Jamaica, come to the Bahamas. And this was like the middle of winter. I mean, of course, I started in the fall. So this was like, you know, October, November, where it started feeling cold. And my first thought was really, I was really curious, you know, being an immigrant myself, and also, you know, being the daughter of somebody who came here undocumented, and then, you know, having to work hard to, like, have me be here educated. I started wondering about their lives. What were the lives they left behind? Who are they now? And, you know, I was sitting with that thought. You know, I was going back and forth to work, sitting with that thought. And Patsy started speaking to me then. I was really curious about this woman who actually came to America, of course, for that American dream, you know, and still we don't know what the American dream is. We're still unpacking what that is. But for me, it was just a curiosity that grew into this one character, this one woman who actually left home, left a child behind. And what made me follow Patsy even further was that, you know, I started having, interactions with these other immigrants who are here working as nannies or working cleaning people's homes. And one of the things that, you know, we see them all, you know, living in a place like New York City, we see them all the time. But really to stop and ask ourselves, and for me being young, a younger generation of immigrant, asking myself, you know, who are these women we see pushing these babies on the Upper West Side or the Upper East Side? Usually we see them, we know who they are as these women, but for me as a writer, giving them that interior life. And so for Patsy, for me, is that character that I wanted to follow, who actually I wanted to dissect, to unpack, you know, given that she's more complex. She has a very complex character, more than what we see each day walking the streets of the city. So for me, it was also exploring gender dynamic in both places. But as a woman who is here to find herself, she's not the altruistic immigrant. And I said here early on the podium, you know, usually when you hear the immigrant story, people come to this country, given that he has more resources, with the hopes of sending things back home, money or whatever it is back home to help their family. But for Patsy, she's here for herself. And for me, it's exploring in terms of womanhood, right, in terms of what's expected of us as women. You know, here she's given the role of mother, and she doesn't think she can live up to that role. And it's really, the question then becomes, you know, what do we lose when we choose ourselves, especially as women? And that's really the core of Patsy's story for me.
All right, well, I'll follow up with a question, and maybe you guys will feel brave afterwards. Both of you write about these seemingly neglected histories of your homes, whether it's about the AIDS epidemic specific to Chicago, or LGBTQA+ in Jamaica and the immigrant experience. And I'm wondering, it's two parts, what challenges you faced when writing about these, and also, did it change your relationship to your homes in writing these books?
Yeah. I know, given that I was writing a woman who literally left her daughter, for me, it was very challenging at first, to be honest with you, because here I was, you know, finding myself judging her on the page. When I first started Patsy 7 years ago, it was really hard to write a character like that, knowing, you know, I kind of knew that she was here existing as this immigrant, but for some reason, when the thought of her leaving a young child behind came about, it took me a while to really put that narrative on the page. I really danced around it for a very, very long time. And I actually realized that I was also, you know, guilty of judging her, given that I had internalized so much as a woman in society already. So for me to write that, I'm like, oh my God, my readers are gonna like throw this book across the room. Like, this woman is like, you know, a horrible, horrible person. And so for myself, really getting into that that dialogue in my head, but I had to silence it, because for me, it's also important for me not to judge a character when I write. Same for my first book, Here Comes the Sun. You know, Margot was a prostitute who also commodified the bodies of young girls. And I judged her, too, in the beginning. But what I learned from that experience writing a Margot and writing Patsy is that when I let go, when I actually stop judging these characters, they take me through the book. They open up a whole new avenue, and the story just becomes real and authentic. And as ugly as their choices are, I realize that they're human beings just placed in very difficult circumstances. So in Patsy's life, you know, she felt stuck in Jamaica, given that in a country like Jamaica, upward mobility is really hard. So it's really important. It was really important for her to leave home to actually achieve what she needed to achieve. Again, be ignorant of what she would meet here without papers. But, you know, I wanted to still give her that grace, still be able to have her have, you know, the internal conflicts and also the context that would actually help people to actually understand her decisions, but also as a writer myself, you know, the ability to just let go and have Patsy lead the way. So that was really my biggest challenge.
I've lived in Chicago my whole life, basically, aside from college, and this writing this book, researching this book, completely transformed the city for me in very almost literal ways where I feel like you know, some of my research, I was, you know, literally walking around with people and they were telling me what used to be there, or, you know, this same bar was here, but it looked like this. This is where my friend did this. And you have this sort of palimpsest, you know, over the city of all these things that you now know. I had this lovely research intern one summer, a college student, and I had him, I found a directory of every, it was a 1986 directory of every gay bar in the city, and I had him make me this interactive electronic map that I could access on my computer where he put pins all over the city. And then I was putting my character's apartments and like tracking, you know, so like where would they walk, what would they pass, because it's not all there anymore. But then I would walk around with that on my phone and like map out where they were. So, and then on top of it, there were actual historical events. Late in my book, I write quite a bit about this demonstration, a national demonstration that ACT UP did in 1990 in Chicago. And they were all over downtown. And it's a pivotal scene in my book. It was also, I think, a pivotal moment in Chicago AIDS history and in national AIDS history. They were there to protest both the American Medical Association, which was headquartered there, and a lot of those insurance companies that were doing things like what I just read about, and at a time when AZT costs $700 a pill. And there was also pharma sales involved. They were protesting pharmaceutical companies. They were all over. And there's a scene that I write about in the book that happened, and partly I've talked to people who were there, and partly this footage is on YouTube. Someone, just like the 1986 Pride Parade, someone had this camcorder out there, and then their VHS cassette sat in some basement for like 25 years, and now it's on YouTube. And I watched it again and again and again, and the thing that just was incredible to me that I write about is there was this moment where they're all in front of the county building downtown, and these five guys had gotten into the county building wearing business suits. And then they got out up on this ledge above this door, and they took off their, you know, shirts, and they were wearing ACT UP t-shirts underneath, Silence Equals Death shirts. And they unfurled this huge banner that said, "We demand equal health care now." And then they're very brutally dragged back through the window, one by one, by the police. The police were incredibly violent with these protesters always, and then they would wear latex gloves because they didn't want to touch them at the same time. And there's this moment where two or three have been dragged back in. And the other ones realize they have this extra minute out on the ledge. They'd been leading these chants, you know, from up above. And they realize they have extra time, and they kind of stand back up and start leading the chants again. And one of those guys in particular, I know he died just a few months after that. He was just this incredible person. There were two survivors, and one of them sat down and talked to me. And I felt like I was talking to, like, Paul Revere. You know, like, I've been studying you. I have a photo of you in, like, my wallpaper laptop. My laptop wallpaper was, like, a photo of a group of men at a candlelight vigil, and he was one of them. And he sat down and talked to me. But so the city just, the city has been overwritten with this history for me, in this, and it should be. You know, these are battles that were fought for all of our freedom, for all of our health. And you know, you when there's an actual battlefield, they mark it. You know, you have, you know, Civil War battlefields, or you have, you know, all this stuff here in Philadelphia. This is where these things happen, and you can feel that when you walk by. We don't have the markers in Chicago, and I bet you don't necessarily have those in Philly for the same events. But if you know, you can feel it. You're on sacred ground when you stand there, and I'll just never look at my city the same way.
Rebecca, I have a question for you. You had spoken that when you started speaking, you spoke briefly about the challenges of writing about the gay community in Chicago in the 80s, and it's understandable. But I thought the book engendered such empathy for the characters in ways that were surprising and like resonated emotionally. I think in ways that other books weren't able to achieve. So I wondered whether you did that deliberately, or if it, in once you started researching it, you felt like you wanted to create an empathetic story, or yeah. It came more naturally.
Yeah, thank you. You know, I was never going to go near a story like this without tremendous empathy, and I don't think writers have any business going near any stories without empathy. I think that earlier in my career, something I had to learn, I made the mistake, I think, in some of my very early work, of holding certain characters at a sort of ironic distance. And I don't think I was doing myself any favors by doing that. I knew going into this book that, first of all, it needed to be utterly, you know, utter realism, as close as I could get, whether that was in terms of the details I was researching or in terms of, you know, psychology, really, really getting close to the characters. And I knew that, you know, I was writing about lived history. As much as my characters are inventions, bless you, I needed to honor this incredible legacy of people, many of whom aren't around to speak for themselves, and many of whom are, one of my greatest wishes with this book, and I've been so thrilled when this is borne out, is that this is maybe the book that in some cases someone picks up by accident because their book club picks it up and they didn't know anything about the AIDS crisis. And then afterwards they start reading a lot more stuff, maybe stuff by direct voices. They start watching documentaries. And my book is doing other things than that. It's not just about the AIDS crisis, but I love when that happens, that it gets people on sort of a reading jag. I was trying also deliberately, though, not to be manipulative. I mean, I think there's something really gross about reading a book or watching a movie where you can tell that, like, you're supposed to feel sorry for this perfect, pure, innocent person, and then something really bad is going to happen. And it was very important to me that my characters be flawed, that I not be so afraid of writing across difference that I made all my characters glow-in-the-dark saints, because I think that would be disrespectful in a different way. And also, nobody likes a perfect character, actually. You know, that you try that and then think nobody relates. So, yeah.
Thank you and good evening. Thank you to both of your lives and your work and your ability to share with us to help us grow. So my question is for both of you respectfully. If you could have an imaginary literary dinner party, what writers would each of you invite to the dinner party?
Ooh, I love this. Do you want to go first?
Oh my gosh.
You have to go first, because I know.
I would say, I just literally launched this book on Tuesday, and I was asked the very same question at the book launch, actually. So, yeah. But, first of all, Toni Morrison, she's my mother, my literary mother, literally, because she brought me to literature. Prior to reading Toni Morrison, I never saw myself in books. I never saw authors who looked like me, who sounded like me. So, when I saw a copy of Beloved sitting in my library, in my high school library, that blew me away. And that was actually what turned me on to Toni Morrison. And so I've been reading everything by her. And I just feel like she's the one who gives me permission now to write women's sexuality in the way I do, to write about a community of people I care about, which is working class Jamaican women and our complexities, the way how she writes about Ohio, you know, communities there, especially when you read like Sula, for example. I also would have Zora Neale Hurston at the table, given that I also write dialect, and she gave me that license to incorporate dialect in my own books as well, because I write, like I said, I write Jamaican characters, and so two Jamaican characters would not be speaking to each other in standard English straight. We'll have our dialect in the dialogue as well. And when I saw Zora achieve that, I'm like, well, I can do it as well, you know, just to make my characters as authentic as possible. And it's really important for me. Yes, I write universal themes, which we're going to discuss again, hopefully, as the night progress, but I use protagonists who look like me, right, who sound like me, and so to be speaking to each other, of course, the dialect for me is powerful. It brings a reader to the page who probably otherwise, who probably had not picked up a book feeling the same how I did when I was a young girl. You know, so if they come across Patsy, or if they come across Here Comes the Sun, they can actually be like, oh my God, I'm hearing myself. You know, this is me. You know, the mirror is there, and probably being empowered. Another person I would have at the table is Edwidge Danticat. You know, I love the way how she also writes. She writes about Haiti, again, showing tremendous compassion for her characters, and I really admire that, and also the immigrant experience as well. So Edwidge Danticat for sure at the table, and Paul Marshall, another Bajan American author, and those would be my top people.
So you went with living authors. Am I allowed to go with dead authors? Okay, I can resurrect the dead. Ooh, fun. Yeah, I think you have such noble intentions. I'm like, my intentions are like, I want to see if I can outdrink F. Scott Fitzgerald. Like, I have like, I know I can't. I'm kidding. But no, I would want to have people who I think would be kind of have a wild party, you know? So I think Fitzgerald is invited. I think maybe not, well, I'm not going to write, not everyone's going to be wild, but like people, I want like Ralph Ellis in there. I think he'd be really interesting. I want Dorothy Parker, but I think she would not want to be at my dinner party. I think she'd be kind of, because she was like, if you read biographies of her, she was like always like leaving the party early and being released. I mean, she was like having fun at lunch, but I think she was like not wanting to, she was like, yeah, like kind of an introvert. And actually, come to think, so my grandmother was a novelist. She wrote in Hungarian, so I can't really read her work. And she died when I was a baby, so I would throw her in with a translator, and then yeah, and she would like take no bullshit from F. Scott Fitzgerald either. So would you know? I don't actually really like him that much, despite the fact that I used his. I mean, I love him, but I also he frustrates me, despite the fact that I used his title for his words for my title. I have like issues with him. I think that's why I want to ask him questions.
Right. Yeah. You know, can I add one more person? I'll actually have James Baldwin as well.
Oh, yeah.
I feel like we'll have so much in common.
He can come to both.
Right,
okay.
Yes. Okay. We'll have so much in common because, you know, it was James Baldwin who said, you know, he loves America so much that he can critique it. And that's how I feel about Jamaica. I love Jamaica so much that I feel like, yes, I can critique it. I mean, lovingly. You know, writing the good, the bad, and the ugly. And so I guess me and James Baldwin would probably be drinking our red wine and identifying, you know, and also like this concept of feeling like a sister outsider. So of course I'll bring Audre Lorde along because she would also be into the whole conversation. You know, here I was growing up in a country feeling like an outsider, growing up a lesbian, feeling like I was the only lesbian on the island. And I feel like Audre Lorde could have probably impart a certain like kind of wisdom, because she, you know, has Caribbean heritage as well, and she grew up with immigrant parents in Harlem, coming out to herself and being vocal about it. And she'd probably tell me, you know, probably as she's getting her coat and her hat, she'd say, "Girl, our silences cannot protect us. Continue writing." And I was like, "Oh, thank you, Audrey." And you know, the night would be great.
It sounds like she already lives in your head in
right,
a very
yes,
helpful
exactly.
way. So
yeah.
Well, we do have to wrap it up, so we have enough time for the signing upstairs, and I hope that you all will join us up there. But let's give another round of applause for Rebecca Mackay and Nicole Dennis-Benn.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.